hard-hitting medical truth, cutting through conflict and confusion to the understanding you're searching for. Join Dr. Peter McCullough, world-renowned medical expert and practicing physician, for this edition of the McCullough Report. Your life may depend on it.
Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, this is the McCullough Report. It's a great pleasure to welcome to the show, for the first time, someone who I have been communicating with now for nearly 4 years through the pandemic, a terrific, terrific scientist and investigator from Mexico, Karina Acevedo Whitehouse. And I tell you what, and she has more names than that, as so many people in the world of Latin America do. I think it's great to have all the names you can figure out, the mothers and fathers. But I'm going to let her introduce herself, and then we've got a great topic, including her most recent book. Karina, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me here in the space. Thanks.
Why don't you kick it off and just give us your background? It's so extensive. It's so impressive. Take your time. I want people to understand who you are.
Thanks, Peter. Well, I'm a vet. I'm a veterinarian doctor from Mexico City. And then I decided I wanted to work with research rather than with clinical medicine. So I did a master's in disease ecology up north in Mexico. And then I went to the University of Cambridge in the UK. And I did a PhD in immunogenetics. And then I stayed on for 6 more years. And I did a postdoctoral research fellowship in epidemiology of wild populations. And after that, I was asked to return to my country I was offered a position as a professor here at the University of Querétaro in central Mexico. And I've been there for 14 years, teaching on virology, immunology, epidemiology, and conducting research with natural populations, especially with marine mammals. So that's sort of my background. I use marine mammals as models, but I focus on immunology, epidemiology, microbiology.
Wow. So are you primarily in the classroom or the laboratory or both?
Sort of a combination. I mean, I do have some terms where I have very high teaching duties, but others I have more time for research. And I always go to the field as much as I can. I love that. So yeah, sort of a balance. And obviously training graduate students and writing papers. Well, you know how it is. So yeah, pretty busy days.
Well, how did you become interested in SARS-CoV-2 infection, COVID-19, the illness?
I know. I mean, it's odd. I was offered a chance by my university to be a part of the efforts that we were doing there to communicate science to people in regard to COVID. So because of my background and because I lecture on these topics, I was asked to participate every Tuesday at the local television station of my university. So I started that way, and it was just 20 minutes every week. And obviously, I had to prepare quite a lot for that. So I did that. And that forced me to become very, very, I don't know if updated is a term, because I think it's practically impossible for everyone to know everything that's been published. It's just crazy the amount of publications that have come out. But I became very aware of things that just didn't sound right from the start. Things that I thought, that's odd that they're saying this, because we don't really have any scientific evidence for this or this. But in the beginning, Peter, I mean, everyone was just so scared of what was going on. I think that we didn't have time to think of what was going on. I was just preparing things. But that started being like a sort of a warning sign of what was happening. And I just continued that way until towards October, more or less, when people started talking about the vaccines that were going to come out. I started doing quite a lot of research on these vaccines. And that's when I realized that things were really odd, because they weren't really vaccines, because this was gene therapy, because we had very little information about that. So I just started talking about that, thinking that there wasn't going to be a problem. I mean, it's an academic venue. We sort of try to encourage that, right? I mean, science should be about dissent and this and just dialogue. And that's when things just went haywire. And it was just terrible. So basically, I was uninvited from those programs. But and all my videos started getting taken down from YouTube. I mean, the videos from the university, it was just terrible. They actually closed one of the channels from the university. They had to open another. And yeah, it was quite a lot. So then that's when I started understanding what was really going on, or at least to some extent. And I continued doing as much as I could to help people understand what was going on, trying to avoid telling people what to do. That's not really my thing. It's more trying to explain, and people should make an informed decision. And so my life changed quite suddenly and unexpectedly from being well respected in my field and not to suddenly by at least in some venues I was seen as a anti-vaxxer, and I was saying, but I'm not an anti-vaxxer, that's not what it's about. So I mean, I'm sure you've gone through that as well, but it just made me more convinced that this was something I had to do. I mean, how is it, Peter, that one can know and then be quiet? You can't be quiet about things you find out. You just can't be quiet. So yeah, that's sort of the story that led me here and led me to the book, actually.
We're going to get to the book in a little bit, but you know, you were active with Roxana Bruno, myself, and as I counted, it was 57 authors, 17 countries on a paper that we put together in the spring of 2021, and we published it on Authoria preprint server in May of 2020. We said we had questions regarding these vaccines to public health authorities. Tell us about that paper.
Well, basically, it was precisely that. It was just raising our voices, saying there are many questions, there are things that we don't know about, and we need to stop pretending that we have those answers. We don't. So all we're saying is we need the research to be done, and we need people to acknowledge, yeah, we don't know that. I mean, sometimes I think, Peter, how different things would have been if they had said, well, actually, what we developed was gene therapy. And no, we don't know what the consequences are in terms of genotoxicity, in terms of integration, in terms of what can happen to babies if mothers are vaccinated. We don't know. Do you want to go ahead with it? It would be a very different scenario, Peter, obviously. But it's not valid to just be quiet about these things. So that's why we put this paper together. At that point, it was just asking the questions. But I mean, I'm sure you know that asking questions now is a dangerous thing to do, just asking the questions. So yeah, that was the story of that paper. Obviously, we were never able to publish it in a peer-reviewed journal or anything like that. It's as a preprint, as you said. But I think the questions were there quite early. And at least we did our part in saying, well, we don't know this. And then I continued on with Roxana Bruno, and we published a paper in the journal Medical Hypothesis. Mm-hmm. That was quite an effort to get that published, and it's quite a story there. The editor got back to us and said, well, actually, I can't publish this, even if we had good reviews. And he said, we can't publish this. And why can't you publish it? Well, because it's a hypothesis. I said, well, yeah, and the journal is called Medical Hypothesis, right?
Yeah.
That's exactly what we did. We're not saying this is a fact, it's a hypothesis. So we just went back and forth with that. And finally, I said, just think what type of scientist you want to be. I mean, if you are responding to pressures, then what can I say? And the paper was published. So that was pretty nice. And I'm grateful to
Good
the editor for being honest with himself.
Have you ever faced this before, where you published a paper and then there was backtracking and threatened retractions? Have you ever faced this before?
No, never. I mean, never in my academic career that's been going on for nearly 25 years. I had never had so much trouble publishing a paper. I've never had any experience where something I publish becomes retracted. I mean, never. And this has become so common. I have seen the papers that you've written that have become retracted. There's one that just happened. Another one with Jessica Rose that you wrote that I thought was fantastic, and it was just retracted. And that's happening. And I really think that as scientists, we have to be really ashamed of what's going on with our profession, because science is not an abstract concept, Peter. Science is simply the way in which we have understood that it's best to gather knowledge and to question it and to make it advance. I mean, if science did not have that questioning, then we would continue doing things that were done in the 13th century. I mean, science, the knowledge that we have evolves. It's not an abstract concept, and it's not something that is independent of what we as scientists do. So that's why I think we really need to be ashamed of what we've allowed as a profession to occur. We are all responsible to a higher or lesser degree of what's going on. And I feel really bad about that. And in some aspects, it's been like having to let go of ideas. I think that in many aspects, I was naive, thinking that scientists were always going to be the ones that raise their voice. But no, I think that our profession is quite conservative. We don't respond well to changes of paradigms. And I think that there's a lot of cowardice as well.
Yeah, I had a patient today, CEO of a company who's been debilitated from the vaccine. And we went through everything, and you know, he had been to the Mayo Clinic. He could go anywhere he wants to. And we were lamenting that really COVID-19 was the big challenge. This was for the bravado of science and medicine for us to, you know, overcome this worldwide threat. And boy, the medical orthodoxy failed miserably. They failed on early treatment. They failed on this, the vaccines, to, you know, not even have a discussion about this novel genetic mechanism and you know what could happen. Now, before we get into the topic, because I really have always wanted to ask somebody this and understand it, just with SARS-CoV-2 infection, is there reverse transcription of any of the genetic material into the human genome?
Well, I mean, the paper that was published in, I think it was late 2021, I may be wrong, maybe it was early 2022, they showed that there was this reverse transcription of part of the genome. So that was published in PNAS, and then there were some issues that came out with that paper, obviously in the same sort of style that we've been talking about, that it's easy for papers that say something against the main narrative, then they get sort of attacked. But I mean, that paper wasn't even looking at vaccines or anything like that. They were just showing that there was integration that was possible. And they were trying to see if that could explain long COVID. So if that could explain spike being produced, the spike protein being produced for a long time. And that's not what they saw. What they saw was there could be integration, but in one particular extreme, one region of the genome. And that was very interesting. And I actually didn't know that. I didn't know that that was possible. And I mean, I teach virology. That's one of the subjects that I teach. But I didn't know that. And when I started looking into it, Peter, I was shocked because it has been something that is known for, I think, like 1988, something like that onwards. Not many papers have been published, but they have shown that parts of the genome of certain viruses, and I'm not speaking about HIV or retroviruses like that. So say Ebola or Marburg or other viruses that are RNA viruses can become integrated, which means that there's a reverse transcription. That means RNA becomes written into DNA, double chain, double strand, and that goes into the nucleus and becomes integrated. So they know that that can happen. And I find that as a scientist, I find that fascinating because it could even be a process that is part of an innate immune response of the cell. So you detect foreign genetic material and potentially that sort of grasping a little piece of it and integrating it into the nucleus could be part of that. I just find it fascinating. But what that implied was that that might happen with the foreign genetic material of the vaccines. So that led to another paper that hasn't been retracted as far as I know in 2023 by Alden and others from a Swedish university. And they saw in an in vitro experiment, so this was a hepatic cancer cell lines, they saw that it could actually become reverse transcribed and enter the nucleus. And they stopped there. They didn't check to see if it was integrated because they're two different things. Mm-hmm. But at least we know that now. And I do know that many colleagues were saying, well, yeah, but that was done in vitro. It wasn't done in a live organism. That's true. And they didn't try to extend their findings beyond that. And they said, well, this was done in a cancer cell line. And we know that that expresses one of these elements that can do reverse transcription. Yeah, fine. We don't know if that could happen in other cells that have less expression or no expression of line. That's true. But at least it shows that the mechanism can occur, Peter. And I think that that is something that people need to know because it's part of informed consent. And that's part of it, of saying this might happen. Maybe it won't, but it might. So those are the things that really, really got me upset when I was seeing what was going on. And I do know that it's been sort of disappointing for some people that just want to do what the establishment says. And they said, how can you do that, Karina? How can you be talking about these things? I mean, just focus on your research. Don't do anything else. But how can you, Peter? How can you just ignore that? I can't.
No, it is the ethical dilemma of all time. And it just landed in our careers. Now, did the consent form in Mexico, let's say for the messenger RNA vaccines, did the consent form evolve over time to mention reverse transcription or integration?
No, very few things of this established narrative have changed over time, to be fair, very few things. I mean, that would have been great if there had been moments in which health authorities get together and say, okay, let's evaluate what happened and let's update and let's say we're sorry for this. Or, okay, if you don't want to say you're sorry, just say we've changed what we think now. Mm-hmm. But that really hasn't happened. And the thing with informed consent in Mexico, at least as far as I know, in many places, they didn't even give informed consent, Peter. It wasn't something that was widespread and everyone had it. I mean, people I've asked about, they say, no, they didn't give me anything. I mean, they just gave me that paper that said, here's the vaccine. Some don't even have the lot number. So no, definitely not. I mean, it might be that in some places they said something a little bit deeper, but to the best of my knowledge, no, that wasn't there.
Is there any estimate of the percent of the population that took the vaccine and those who are unvaccinated?
For Mexico, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, official figures, let's say Our World in Data plus the government of Mexico, talk about like nearly 70%. They never specify if that includes the entire population or only over 18. They never say that. But it's very difficult to know in Mexico because they didn't only have like US genetic vaccines, which I call in the book vax genes. I think that that's a better term for them. But no, here we had a combination thing. So there was Pfizer and there was Moderna and there was Janssen, AstraZeneca, CanSino, the CoronaVac, Sputnik. So then it makes it very difficult to know how many people really received one of these mRNA vaccines, at least in our country and others. So, I mean, for instance, New Zealand, I think it was only Pfizer that they used. That makes it a little bit easier in terms of seeing trends and things. But here it's an epidemiological nightmare, the way you have. Yeah, I mean, it's just too many variables and it makes it very difficult to understand. And then you have another component in Mexico. I mean, that I'm just saying it outright. We also have a lot of chaos in Mexico. What does that mean? That in some places, for instance, you had people that were becoming, they were going to get vaccinated and they were there all day waiting in the queue in line. And it's very, very hot in some places in Mexico in the summer. So then you had these ice boxes where they had the vaccine vials and that was out all day. So you have a lot of variation in that sense. And maybe that's for the good. Maybe that's better for people. I don't know. But you had that. And then there were some places where at least they were saying, I don't know if it's true or not, that some vaccines were getting moved into the dark, the black market. And instead of vaccinating people, they were vaccinating water vials. I don't know. But all that chaos, I think, makes it very difficult to understand the patterns that you see later on with who has an adverse reaction and who doesn't, at least in our country.
Now, when did you have an understanding that the vaccines were causing serious safety issues like death,
Yeah.
and cardiovascular neurologic complications?
I mean, to be able to say it without a doubt that the vaccine caused that, I think it's very difficult to say that. I mean, because we have limited information of causality, like cause effect without a doubt, that's very difficult. But when I started realizing, yeah, there is a problem, it was very, very soon. Since October, I started reading the literature that was available, especially what was available with AstraZeneca type vaccines, so these vectorized vaccines that use adenoviruses, because we did have more things published about this. So we knew since, I don't know, it was 2007, something like that, that there could be this issue of causing blood platelets to coagulate. I mean, we had all that information out there. So I knew that was going to be an issue. But in, I think it was the end of January, and I mentioned that in the book, I was contacted by email by a guy, a Spanish guy that lived in the UK. I didn't know him, and he was desperate because his wife had had exactly that VITT syndrome after receiving AstraZeneca, and she was forced to be vaccinated. It was mandatory vaccination because she's a nurse. And she practically died. I mean, I didn't know what had happened with her. It's just the story sounded terrible. And I was really afraid that she had died. I mean, he wrote to me several times and then he just became silent. And it was terrible. That was really at the start. And I said, what we've been seeing in these publications and what I told some people in videos that I was doing, this is a risk. It's starting to happen. So I saw that since January 2021. And then after that, it has just been testimony after testimony, plus all the data in theirs, which of course could be that it's not causally linked. I'm not saying it is, but there is a trend. And that is what those platforms are for, Peter. That's exactly what they're for, to be able to identify patterns. And they're being ignored now. So then, yeah, it might be that it's not that. It might be that it's something else, but we have to look at it instead of ignoring it. So yeah, the answer is pretty soon I started realizing that this was a problem.
Wow, so you are on it. January of 2021, October, just by mechanism, you were concerned. Now, in Mexico, were all the vaccines offered free of choice, and did the government push any particular one?
They were offered for free. I mean, people didn't have to pay for them, but they were assigned to different groups. So, for instance, Pfizer was assigned to people that were elderly. And then AstraZeneca, I don't know if in the whole country, but at least in the central part of Mexico, AstraZeneca was especially for students, so university students, which I find terrible because that's the age group where you have a lot of problem with these VITTs. So we had that. And then there were some other places where CanSino was offered to teachers, for instance. So in my university, teachers would get CanSino. So Cansino is a Chinese one. I think you guys didn't have it over there in the US. It wasn't
So is
authorized.
that the killed virus vaccine?
No, that's coronavac. No, Cansino is also an adenovirus-based
Oh, it
vaccine.
is. Wow,
Yeah.
okay.
So Mexico got that one as well, and Sputnik was offered in some other places. But so yeah, so it was sort of by ages, but also by sort of at least professions in terms of teachers, the military, and also university level students.
Wow. It's interesting. None of the countries, including the United States, they didn't seem to care what was the best vaccine or what was the safest vaccine. It just seemed like take a vaccine, take any vaccine.
Yeah, although in the US you only had three options, I think. It was Moderna, Pfizer, or Janssen. That was it. I
Well,
think you guys.
we had Novavax. Novavax had great data by June of 2021, and they were delayed for a full year for no reason to June of 2022, and they entered the market. They're an antigen-based vaccine, and they don't get the light of day. The CDC and FDA don't promote it. They just only promote the. They didn't even promote Janssen. They just promote the messenger RNA vaccines. 94% of Americans who took a shot took
Got that.
messenger RNA vaccine.
Yeah, I know. And that's one of the things that I find quite concerning, that that is the technology that they're trying to push to make all vaccines that type of vaccine. Even if that's not really a vaccine by definition, but that is what they're trying to push. And I can understand the logic behind that. You don't even have to go to any sort of conspiracy theory. Just in economical terms, it's very cheap to make it. Very, very cheap. And you can have it very quickly because all you need are the lipid nanoparticles and the sequence. So you can make that, turn it into the what you want, the type of vaccine that you want, just by knowing the sequence. You can change it very easily. So I'm not surprised that that's what they're pushing. But the thing is, and I try to make that point clear in the book, that this goes beyond the COVID vaccines, Peter. This is any vaccine that has this technology. And all I'm saying is we need to look into things that they are giving it as a fact. They're telling people that it's safe without having looked at many aspects. I mean, that is just the way it is. It's a fact. It's not an opinion. And the question is, why are we doing that? Why is the medical establishment, why is the scientific community allowing things to be taken as safe when we do not know if they are? And the evidence now is showing that they're not. So
Right,
then that
we couldn't have known. You think about it. The Pfizer Moderna trials were 2 months long.
Of
I
course.
guess you include three if you just didn't count the first primary series phase. In 3 months, no one knew what would happen after 3 months. And so when they were rolled out, they were told safe and effective forever. I mean, so no one knew. We've been talking to Dr. Karina Acevedo-Whitehouse. She's a terrific scientist, a veterinarian from central Mexico. She's an academic, extensively published. We're going to take a station break right now, and then we're going to come back on the backside and introduce her book. I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. You're listening to the McCullough Report. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Often, there are no symptoms, but left unattended, we become inundated with one health problem after another. It's time to fight back with HealRight. HealRight is a bar that you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Developed by world-renowned scientists and backed by 15 years of research, HealRight is effective, but it's also delicious and works without additional diet or lifestyle changes. Step out of the statistics and use food as medicine. Visit healright.com/outloud or americaoutloud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
58 million people suffer from joint aches and stiffness in the U.S. every day. Ignoring chronic joint discomfort can affect mobility and your quality of life. Advanced nutrition company, HealthyCell, created joint health and mobility to support connective tissue, joint lubrication, and reduce joint irritation with curcumin, omega-3, chondroitin, glucosamine, and hyaluronic acid for joint comfort and flexible range of motion. And HealthyCell's not a pill. It's a patent-pending gel you swallow with clinically proven ultra-absorption of science-backed ingredients. you would need to take 11 pills to get the same amount of nutrients in each gel pack. And these great tasting gels come in a small packet. Tear off the top, shoot it down, or mix it in water. It's 100% drug-free joint support. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. HealthyCell.com, code OUTLOUD for 25% off.
Who's got time for a nasal invasion messing up your lifestyle? Crush those nasties before they become a problem. For a limited time, when you add the new Cofix RX throat spray to your order with the coupon code OUTLOUD, you'll receive 20% off the entire purchase. Go to AmericaOutLoud.shop. That's AmericaOutLoud.shop and use coupon code OUTLOUD.
Use Cofix RX because it works.
When God, through his grace and mercy, gave us free will of the people was to live freely. To that end, we fight for the liberty of all at a time when global tyranny threatens us as never before in mankind's history. This vision is manifest at AmericaOutLoud.news, a site for all who cherish free will and freedom. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. Well, I tell you what, the back half, we are going to talk about this book. I'm going to show you. We have the author here, and you know what? She is amazing. I'm not doing too good in front of the camera, but you can see Karina Acevedo Whitehouse. She's from Central America. She did part of her training in the UK. That's the reason why her English is terrific, I imagine, which is really an advantage. But look at the title of this book, Adverse Effects, A Critical Review of COVID Vax Genes. Wait a minute, vax genes. This is the first time I've heard about this. How'd you come up with that term?
I don't know. It was just like a play of words, I suppose, Peter. I was trying to think how to call them because many people say, well, the COVID vaccines, and they'd make this little type of symbol. Well, yeah, but they're not vaccines. I mean, they're not. And words are important. Definitions are important. Concepts are important. And we've just seen so much being slaughtered in that sense. I mean, they come up with new terms like hybrid immunity that doesn't even mean anything. And if we start calling these products vaccines, then we're sort of in the same line of just ignoring facts. And I don't like that. I don't like that at all. So then in Spanish, I call them genetic vaccines. But then I'm still using that term. And in English, suddenly I was just playing with the words. And I said, well, vaccine, vaccine, there you go. There you have it. It's a new concept. Because that is not a vaccine. It's something else. It's gene therapy that's been tried to be used to immunize, even if it's not really doing that for many reasons. So yeah, that's the reason why I allowed myself to play with the term.
Have you written books before?
Chapters in books related to my area of studies with marine mammals and immunology. So yeah, I've written chapters, never a full book. No,
never a full book. So this is the first time. This is the this is the maiden voyage, huh? Well, it's quite a tome. Now you challenge us when you show on the cover a door opening with some light coming through, and you say, "Do you choose to understand?" What do you mean by that?
Okay, so originally that was not going to be the cover. So I was going to put the figure that appears in the introduction that has like a Petri dish with three faces. And I had asked a student of mine that draws really nicely. I said, could you make this? I tried to describe what I wanted because I feel that has been happening during this pandemic. It's based on this image that's in a shrine in a temple in Japan that has three monkeys. I'm sure your audience has seen them. One is covering the eyes, the other the ears, and the other the mouth. It's very, very well known. Mm-hmm. And I wanted something that showed that, but with humans, because that's what has been happening. People don't want to see, people don't want to hear, people don't want to speak for many reasons, fear, basically. But there are other reasons there. It could be you don't want to lose status, you don't want to be criticized, you don't want to lose funding. And so I wanted that image with humans. And I said, well, why not in a Petri dish? Because in essence, that's what's happening. We're all just like being plated and grown there and festering into what's happened. So that was going to be the original cover of the book, Peter. And a friend of mine asked me, okay, that's good. But who do you want to read the book? People that already know this topic or people that don't? I said, no, people that don't. He said, then I wouldn't put that in the cover because it's very aggressive. It's very in your face. And I can see the point. So I just thought about it for quite a while. And what do I want to say here? And really, it's in line with what I've been doing these past years, trying to give the information as best as I can, as responsibly as I can. And people choose if they want to listen or not, if they want to continue doing research on it, if they want to understand. It's a choice, Peter. And that's what I'm saying. The information is there. I'm trying to provide it as honestly as possible. And do you choose to read it or not? Do you choose to understand it or not? So in the end, I think that is more accurate in terms of what I'm trying to do with the book.
Yeah, it's kind of opening the light. Well, it is an extensive read. I think it's partly written for the lay public, but it's partly written for professionals as well. And one of the things that caught my eye was just how you lay out what are these products. And you'll recognize this picture here of the base pairs. And then in the table, this is an important table for people to know about. And I'll just read it off. The table says codon family optimization in the synthetic messenger RNA sequences that encode for the spike protein, Pfizer's vaccine, Moderna's vaccines in relation to the SARS-CoV-2 spike genomic sequence. What did they do with the genetic code for Pfizer and Moderna?
So basically, there are different things that they did. One of them, which I do try to explain there in the book, and I'm just going to make a tiny little pause here. I did try to explain it for the layperson, but I also wanted it to be useful for medical professionals and scientists. So it's sort of like a balance there. And I tried to include footnotes, and there was a glossary at the end. And I tried to make it as accessible as possible. But yeah, there are some subjects that are complicated, and there's some terms that are complicated. So anyway, I tried to do it as best as possible. But what they did with the sequence, on one hand, it was turning certain nucleosides that are just some of these little letters that like form the code. They transformed them. They modified them. Why? So that it could become more resistant to being degraded. And that's actually what led to the Nobel Prize, the last one that was given to Carrico and Weissman. So it's that modification that gave them the prize. And it's precisely that modification that's causing quite a lot of the damage that we're seeing that goes beyond the protein that is made due to those instructions. So that's the problem of the mRNA, the synthetic modified mRNA. And the other thing that they did to it was they optimized the codons. So that's why I put that little figure. Codons are three letters, and each of these three letters, nucleotides, are going to code. That means they have the information for one particular amino acid. But there's a lot of redundancy. So you can write one same amino acid in different ways. So when you optimize the codons, what you're doing is change the way it's written. You still get the same amino acid, but you're trying to make it more stable, more resistant to degradation. So those two things together, they did there, was increase the time that mRNA was going to be within the cytoplasm. And they did that without knowledge of what that would cause to the human or to the living organism that received that sequence. So yeah, that's a big problem. And I tried to explain it there as best as I can. And Peter, I was going to tell you something there that applies to the book in Spanish. I wrote this book in Spanish first. So it was published in December, or the 4th of December. And now I translated it. It was quite a feat because it was almost like rewriting the book.
Sure.
I mean, I explored the cost of translating it professionally, and it was just off the scale. And I said, forget it. I don't have the funds for that. So I did it myself. And yeah, I don't think I'll ever translate anything again because it's just so much work. But what I've been offering in Spanish is once a month, there are sessions that people can connect by Zoom and by Facebook so that I can accompany them with doubts that they have of each chapter. I'm not sure if I can offer that in English just because I have limited time available, but I'm trying to do that. I'm trying to help people understand because, Peter, it's essential that people understand what's going on. It's the only way that we can help avoid or at least mitigate a little bit the disaster that's happening right now. At least that's the way I see it.
Oh, yep. You know, so many people, 70 in your book, I think it's 70% of the world has taken a vaccine. Many of them have in their body this messenger RNA. So let's develop this a little bit more. So the spike protein that's produced from Pfizer and Moderna My understanding is that it's full-length spike protein, but it has some special proline insertions that hold it open in the pre-fusion conformation.
Yeah, that's right. So by doing that, then you're sure that it's not going to have the changes that it needs to have in order to interact with ACE2, so the receptor in the cell. And that was an argument that was put forth by many people that were saying, oh, no, these products are safe. It's that it will not fold or change more than fold. It will not change its conformation to expose a fusion peptide, which will allow that protein to start fusing with a membrane. So if this protein, once it's produced, it's excreted from the cell in vesicles or free bound, unbound protein, then it will not cause the problem that would be due to spike joining ACE2. And that's true. But that's not the only problem with spike. It has many other problems that have been already published, have been researched and published in terms of what spike can do. So spike has many, many properties, not very good properties, in terms of affecting the endothelium, so the inside of the vessels, for instance, where it has a pro-inflammatory condition. It causes a lot of inflammation, systemic inflammation, and it can also deregulate the axis that leads to our blood tension, our blood pressure being controlled. So there are many things that it can do. Some of those, if you leave it without that possibility of changing between the two domains, S1 and S2, you won't have them, but you'll have others. But as I said, at least from the way I see it, the problem, Peter, is not only because of spike. That is not the main problem. With these genetic vaccines, you have a problem with the actual information that's there, with the actual sequence. That could be a different type of sequence. It doesn't matter. It's just how long it stays within the cytoplasm. So I described that there, and that's a lot of what Roxana and I were working on the paper that we published in Medical Hypothesis, and that unfortunately other papers have come out showing that many of those hypotheses actually, they've shown that that happens. So I think, and that's what I try to say in the last chapter, in chapter 8, that people need to understand that this goes beyond COVID, Peter. It's not COVID genetic vaccines or COVID vaccines are a problem. They are a problem, but it's the vaccine that's a problem. You can call it something else. You can say now they're developing these for whatever other condition you want, but that's still a problem, even if it's not coding for spike. I don't know if that point is clear.
Yeah, but let's just stay on spike for a minute. So the full-length spike is produced. Now, my understanding is that spike travels in threes. It trimerizes. Is that true?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's true.
And you know, with so many others, you know, before COVID-19, I studied heart and kidney disease and physiology and worked extensively on the natriuretic peptides. And many peptides or proteins, when they interact with a receptor, they undergo receptor-mediated catabolism. And with SARS-CoV-2 infection, when the spike protein interacts with the ACE2 receptor, essentially, my understanding is the S2 segment is sacrificed. It actually does undergo receptor-mediated catabolism, and you end up with the S1 segment. That's what Bruce Patterson described at InCell DX. You end up with the S1 segment inside CD16-positive monocytes. But with
the problem there was that technically, they tried to leave it in that pre-fusion state so that that wouldn't happen. It doesn't mean that that's what occurred, but that's the logic behind doing that.
Well,
that
I know, but so the idea here is with the natural infection, what gets into the body and probably causes long COVID syndrome is the S1 segment. But with the vaccine, one gets the full length spike protein, the pre-fusion conformation, and this pseudo-uridinated modified messenger RNA, nucleoside analog cap, synthetic, that is very long-lasting, very long-lasting. So presumably it can pass from cell to cell or just within the cells it's taken up. It just can produce spike protein endlessly. Does spike protein, in your view, does it get expressed on the cell surface?
It should do. It should do because the sequence, once the protein, the amino acid sequence is generated, there are signals for exportation. You do have that, and it has some transmembrane signals that lead it. I mean, it'll allow it to be expressed in the membrane. So yeah, and that's part of what, in essence, they want. I mean, it's not only MHC-driven expression So MHC, if you recall, it's these proteins that we produce inside every nucleated cell in the body, especially MHC class 1. And what it does is it grasps onto tiny little peptides and it takes it up to the membrane and says, look what I have here. And that will start a reaction. But also you have the spike protein becoming expressed, which is what the virus does in general when it's going to start becoming formed. So all the encapsulation and all the assembly of the virus. So you have it expressed in the membrane because this is an enveloped virus. So you have it that way, expressed. But, so yeah, we would have that.
But if it's expressed at the cell surface and you have major histocompatibility antigens and integrins and other proteins at the cell surface, it's sitting up as a non-human protein.
Of course.
Won't the body's immune system recognize that and attack?
Yeah, of course. Of course. And that's part of the logic. The part of, I'm not saying that I agree with what they're doing at all, Peter, but that was the logic. It's, yeah, of course, you're expressing that. And then your immune system, your lymphocytes, CD8 cells, CDT cells, I mean, all these CD4 cells, they're going to go and attack those cells, but it's going to be localized. So then you'll generate a response and everyone's happy. That's what they said. But that they also said that that would be very local. So it would only be after the injection site, it'll go to the peripheral lymph nodes and then you'll get the response there and that's it. But now we know, Peter, and that is known since October, the things that it wasn't really well known, but that has been known by the agency since October of 2020, that it biodistributes to virtually all the organs, all the systems, all the tissues. It even enters the brain, Peter. So then, yeah, you do have a problem in terms of potential attack to those cells. And what would that cause? Destruction of those cells. So that'll lead to many other problems, among them a pro-inflammatory state. Because when you get damaged cells, that creates something that we call DAMPs, D-A-M-Ps, which are patterns, molecular patterns associated with dead cells. So that will lead to cells, inflammatory cells becoming activated, and that leads to systemic inflammation. So it is a big problem. And I'm not saying, Peter, and I try to be very clear about it in the book, that this is going to happen to everyone. We don't know that. And I've heard some scientists say, everyone who got a vaccine like this, one of these genetic vaccines, is going to have problems in the future. We don't know that, Peter. And I honestly hope that's not the truth. Why? Because we're not mathematical equations, because there's a lot of variability as biological organisms, which we are. Mm-hmm. There's many things that vary amongst us. So it doesn't have to be to everyone. I mean, honestly, I think that whoever says that they don't have the evidence to say that, Peter. Mm-hmm. But it is a possibility. It does lead to that. And that can explain why some people are having the very wide-ranging symptoms that they're having in terms of adverse effects, which are quite wide-ranging. But in essence, there are really four mechanisms that are driving that. Autoinflammatory, autoimmune conditions, that's one of them. Another is hyperproliferation, so leading cells to a more mitotic sort of atmosphere, which they can lead to cancer, that's another one. Endothelial disruption, that's another one. And I can't remember what the other one was, it was chronic. I can't remember what it was. I'll get back to that in a second. But there are four things, four pathological mechanisms that can explain everything that mm-hmm. we're seeing. And I was talking about this with a colleague, and he told me, oh, come on. I mean, this is ridiculous. You're saying that product is causing all this array of symptoms. It can't be. You mm-hmm. can't have one product causing all that. And what I told him was, well, think of cigarettes. Can you think of all the adverse effects that are related to smoking?
Yeah, good point.
It's very wide. Why? Because you understand the pathophysiology. So let me tell you where it is. Hold on a second.
No, that's good. That's a good point. So, you know, smoking, there's about 2,000 different components in tar. People wonder, yeah. Well, why can smoking cause all these problems? Well, it's a complex, smoking is a complex exposure. And it sounds like this is as well.
It's at the beginning of chapter 6, Peter. There I describe the conditions are inflammation and autoinflammation. That's one of them. Mm-hmm. The other is autoimmune conditions. The other is cellular degeneration. And the last one is genomic instability and cellular proliferation.
That's
22. So if we understand the mechanisms that cause that, then the mm-hmm. wide-ranging adverse effects can be understood.
So a couple of questions. Now, just so that everybody knows, make sure you get a copy of this. A lot of people who subscribe to my show, they are really into this. And this is probably, I want to say this is clearly the best work so far that really explains in an understandable way from a molecular perspective what's going on. We've got 8 chapters and then a glossary. So I don't want people to feel like it's too overwhelming. The glossary and the references are really extensive. I mean, they're basically, we're talking about 100 pages. So they're, you know, we're, you know, it is a substantial amount, which is needed in an academic work like this, is needed. In your view, what is likely the catabolic fate of messenger RNA? How does the body get rid of it?
Well, I think it tries. I think it's very difficult for it to be degraded because of these modifications that they made on it. But the body tries to degrade it. So what people need to understand, Peter, is that so we have information in the nucleus of a cell. Normally, forget vaccines. Just think of the cell. In order to survive as an organism, a multicellular organism, or as a single cell, that cell needs to be able to express its information when it needs it. So it's written as DNA, and when we need to express a particular protein, then transcription occurs. So that means DNA is written into RNA, messenger RNA, and that leaves the nucleus, and it goes to the ribosomes, which are there in the plasmic reticulum, right? And then we'll get our protein. But that mRNA becomes degraded. For some of these mRNAs, that happens in minutes, 10 to 15 minutes. That's it. You stopped. In others, it can be hours. But here, it appears to be active even after 186 days. Why 186? Because that's when they stopped the research. It could continue. So for a long time, it's just there within the cytoplasm. So then what's the catabolic fate of it? Well, it cannot be easily degraded by the enzymes that we have normally. That's their job, to degrade it. So then it activates different molecules that lead to a pro-inflammatory state within the cell. So the cell is going to start producing molecules that say, hey, I'm in trouble. Something here is not right. And that'll activate other cells around it to come and try to deal with it. So if that cell is destroyed, then that mRNA would be destroyed. But if it's not, then you just have this sort of like constant signaling, molecular signaling of I'm in trouble. Plus you can activate line. And line one is this enzyme we were talking about, the one that can do reverse transcription. And if that becomes activated, then at least theoretically and proven experimentally with an in vitro experiment, it can make that mRNA become DNA. Pfizer sequence can become DNA and enter the nucleus and then become integrated. What would that mean? That technically it can either interrupt one of these frames for the genes to be in order. You have a frame that's read every three, like every codon. So you have a codon, a codon, a codon. That's the sequence. But if you insert something, that you're displacing that frame. So you can have that, which would be a problem, but you can also have it insert itself in a way that you will start generating, transcribing that mRNA for a long time. How long? Well, I don't know, but that's what papers are showing. People that have had this vaccine continue producing spike protein for a very long time, Peter. I'm sure you've read those papers. For a very long time. And antibody levels are very high against spike, which means you're constantly being exposed to this antigen, which is not a very good idea. So then what's the fate? We don't know. It appears that it could become integrated, at least in these somatic cells. That doesn't mean that the human genome changes because it's somatic cells. So those cells could have that integration of nearly 4,000 base pairs. And if that happens, then you don't have any sort of destruction of that sequence, Peter. I'm not saying that that occurs. I'm saying it could occur with the papers that have come out that have shown that it's possible. So we want to study that here in the university. So it has been approved already as a research project. We're going to study to see if that sequence is becoming integrated in sperm cells of people, of men that have received this vaccine. So we're going to analyze sperm cells of vaccinated men that have received the mRNA vaccines and those that have received the adenoviral vaccines and those that have received the inactivated vaccines and those that have not been vaccinated to see if we can detect the sequence within the sperm cells. And if that is so, Peter, that the implications are very severe.
Wow, that's very, very important work. It's absolutely critical work. Now, back to messenger RNA. So Pfizer, Moderna, messenger RNA. At some point in time, it's used over and over and over again by the ribosomes. Is there fracturing or is there binding of small interfering messenger RNAs, or pieces of RNA? Is there Is there oxidative stress or do ribonucleases, at some point, can the body get rid of this?
Well, I mean, as I said, you do sort of stimulate a danger signal within the cell. It does cause that, which leads to this sort of molecular signaling asking for help. So then what's the fate? That cell can be destroyed. But we don't have one cell that has been transcribed with this material. It has entered many cells in the body. Mm-hmm. So then, yeah, at an individual level, then yes, that cell can be destroyed, but others may not. It may take longer for them to be able to get this sort of help that the immune system can give by destroying them, because that's part of the responses that we have when a cell is damaged. Many times that cell is destroyed, whether entering apoptosis, which is just programmed cell death, so mm-hmm. saying, this is it, I am damaged, I will not continue, or requesting other cells by molecular signals to destroy you. We know that that happens. So it probably might happen, but there are things that have already been published that show that, for instance, these vaccines can lead to the production, differential type of expression of microRNAs. And microRNAs have a role in many different pathologies, Peter, including mm-hmm. cancer. So that has already been published. I'm not saying it happens to everyone. I'm not saying it even needs to happen in vivo, but the in vitro experiments have shown that, Peter.
I know.
That's what needs to be looked at.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I don't want anybody listening to this thing to think that, you know, this is, you know, absolutely no, but we're just trying to work our way through this. So if this messenger RNA is in a cell and the cell expresses on the cell surface and then it's attacked by cells, and the attack involves a complement and it involves other destructive enzymes, myeloperoxidase and others, do you think complement and enzymes, do you think they destroy the messenger RNA, or does the messenger RNA, Pfizer, Moderna, can it survive a catalytic attack from enzymes?
I mean, the real response here, the honest response is we don't know, and we can leave it at that. But we can speculate based on information that we do have of basic biological processes, and knowing what we know about these many different immune responses we can have, it's quite likely, we can hypothesize, that it would become destroyed at some point. Now, that leads me to another thing that I do talk about in the last chapter about self-amplifying vaccines. So that's a different aspect that we still haven't got to with these COVID vaccines, but they're already looking into it as a potential platform. I think there are already a clinical trials that are undergoing with these self-amplifying technologies. And that is even worse, Peter, because there you will continue making and making and making copies of that. So here, in this last scenario, your question is likely to be answered by, no, I don't think that we can get rid of it. But those, to the best of my knowledge, have not been used in humans, at least with the COVID vaccines, except for one clinical trial that I found out about when I was writing the book. I'm sure you know the term BNT162b2. That's the real name of the Pfizer sequence. People just say, oh, the Pfizer vaccine, but that's just the brand of the, it's actually the name of the company, Pfizer. Yeah. But BNT162b2 is the name of the sequence, okay? So there was a clinical trial done with BNT162c2, instead of a B, a C. Mm-hmm. And that is self-amplifying RNA. So some people in this planet received self-amplifying mRNA vaccines as a trial. And nothing has been published about that. You can find the clinical trial, but nothing has been published. So what will happen with these people? Would they be good to sort of follow and see whether they're getting rid of it? Of course we would, but we have no idea who they are, where they are. Those data points have not been released.
You know, the Japanese did approve a self-amplifying
recently.
RNA vaccine for COVID. Yeah. Now, this idea of trying to understand the catabolic fate, this is really important. Why couldn't one just get a vial of Pfizer Moderna, isolate the messenger RNA, and then try different enzymes, caspases and myeloperoxidases and horse peroxidases and what have you?
Yeah.
This is pretty simple work, and it's never been done anywhere.
I don't know if it hasn't been done in other parts of the world. I don't know. In Mexico, it was very difficult to get our hands on vials. It was actually illegal because they declared this a national security event. So mm-hmm. the military were the ones that were in charge of vaccination. And that made it impossible to get vials. So many people would say, well, why don't you analyze them? And all these people that have been talking about looking at graphene under the microscope, for instance. I say, well, there are other ways to do that. But they would say, why don't you do that? Because I cannot get my hands on a vaccine legally. Now we can, because now the vaccines are for sale. So now we are looking into that. What we're trying to do is transfect cell lines. And we're also looking into degradation, enzymatic degradation. As soon as I have those results, I'll tell you about them, I promise.
Oh, good.
I don't know if other researchers in other parts of the world have looked at it, but we're starting to look into it. But before, the reason that we hadn't done it is because we just could not get our hands legally on a vaccine.
But I got to tell you, I mean, I've done drug development work. I've led clinical trials in my career, day safety monitoring boards. This idea of having a product put on the market with no understanding of its metabolic fate, no understanding of pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamics at all. And for years, no one can even study it independently. In my view, it's completely irresponsible. It's greatly irresponsible. Now, you brought it up. I have to ask, I typically don't, you know, even talk about this, but is there graphene oxide in the vaccines?
I mean, again, my honest response would be, I don't know. But what I can tell you is that the most serious report I've seen, and I talk about reports, not publications, because to the best of my knowledge, nothing has been published after peer reviewed on this topic with the COVID vaccines. So we do have quite a lot published on graphene and different pharmaceutical products that has been published. We know that it can be toxic. We know even which is the toxic level, the threshold at which you start seeing effects. We know that. But with the COVID vaccines, to the best of my knowledge, nothing has been published after peer review. So we have our reports, informal reports. And the most serious one I've seen is one by Pablo Campra in Spain. So he's in the University of Almería, and he published something after being commissioned to do so. I don't know how it was that he was asked to do that. He was paid for that, and he accepted. But it was specifically to look for graphene oxide in the vials. Why they wanted to look for graphene oxide, I don't have that part of the story. But if you read that report, and I talk about that in the book, in chapter two, he said, I cannot find unequivocal evidence of graphene oxide. There are some elements in some of the vials that could be graphene oxide, but that was taken as it's a fact and it's everywhere. I try, Peter, to the best of my knowledge, to share information that has a scientific basis for it. And I always say, maybe tomorrow they'll publish something else and we'll say, well, actually, we were wrong with this that we were saying, but at least there's a basis for it. And that has made some people get very angry because they would prefer me to say, no, of course it has, but I cannot do that, Peter. It's not ethical. So my response is, we don't know. It might be. But even if many people have been saying, I have found graphene oxide, okay, let's take that to be right. Okay, how much is there? And I haven't seen a single report saying how much. And if we don't have that information, then all we're doing is speculating, Peter.
Yeah.
Because the poison is determined by the dose. Well, it was Aristotle who said that, or something along those lines. There could be graphene oxide, and maybe it's trace levels. And maybe that amount would be so small that you wouldn't have an effect. Or maybe you have quite a lot of it, and then we need to be concerned about it. While we don't have that information, I think we're just speculating.
Yeah, I say the same thing. I say simply, we don't know, or I haven't seen a convincing report. You know, we're just about out of time. We've been talking to Dr. Karina Acevedo-Whitehouse. The book is Adverse Effects, Coining the Term Vax Genes. You have to take a look at it. Karina, do you have any final words in the last 30 seconds for our audience?
I hope that they choose to understand. The more, as humans, we choose to understand and to have our own opinion about things, an informed opinion, and start reclaiming responsibility in our decisions, I think that we will be able to get out of this mess, because we are in a mess as humanity, Peter. And I just want to thank you for the space, for the time. It's been a pleasure working with you in the past. I hope we continue doing it. And it's great to finally see you.
There we go. And she's so much younger than what I thought, everybody. Dr. Karina Acevedo-Whitehouse, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Peter.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report and Courageous Discourse Substack.